40 miles per hour. This morning, wind is from the west at 25, gusting to 38, 46 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very happy to be spending most of today's program talking about poetry, since April is National Poetry Month or World Poetry Month. It's a time during the year when it makes sense to think about poetry and maybe to appreciate it even more deeply. And we have three people in the studios today who are going to be helping us do that in part one of today's program. And actually, all three of them are past guests on the morning show. Probably the most frequent is my faculty colleague, Dr. Thomas Carr, head of the paleontology program at Carthage College, but wearing another hat today. And actually, that's the hat he was wearing on his last morning show visit as co-poet laureate for Racine. And he is here along with a student with whom he's worked, I should say, a recent Carthage grad, Anthony Gable, who is working as a lab volunteer for Dr. Carr and has participated with Dr. Carr in a new program that Thomas Carr created back in January called Poetry for Dinosaurs. And so it's a way in which these two loves of Thomas Carr are coming together in a really exciting way. And speaking of exciting, I'm also happy to welcome back to the morning show for the first time in quite a while, Nick Ramsey, who sits on the steering committee for the Poet Laureate Program of Kenosha and Racine, and he himself a former Poet Laureate, and he has been observing and cheering on Thomas Carr and this particular project, and is also with us to talk about poetry in general and about this particular program. So, Thomas Carr, Andrew Gable, and Nick Ramsey, we welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have all of you here. It's great to be speaking with you. Nick Ramsey, we're actually going to talk with you first of all, just in general, about this whole notion of poet laureates for Kenosha and Racine. And has this been around even longer than you? Or is this kind of a relatively new program?
Oh, it goes way back. I would say that the first laureate group started in 2011. And that was the brainchild of many different people, but one of those people being John Bloner, if you're familiar with John. He was really the steering force behind it all. So it started back in 2011. There was a round, and it's a two-year term, so just count the decades or the time frame going on. And Thomas is our current Racine Poet Laureate, and it's been around since then.
And what would you say the most important role of the steering committee, of which you are a member, has. I mean, what is your responsibility, and for you particularly, what have you been busy doing in terms of supporting the Poet Laureate program?
The biggest thing is really just supporting our current laureates, however we possibly can. So me being from Racine, my big deal is like helping out both the laureates, but Racine specifically, because, you know, that's where I'm from. So helping Thomas achieve his goals and his focuses. And aside from that, you know, we're cheerleaders, but we're also tasked with viewing all these different applications that come in, and we get them blindly, we vote on them, we talk it through, we have interviews, and basically, you know, that's how we choose the next laureates for each term. So there's a squad of people that love poetry, that really care about it, and our job is to support our laureates and to choose new laureates, and yeah, anything we can do with poetry.
Fantastic. Thomas Carr, you are the current co-poet laureate for Racine along with Mary Skillings. Going into this, I mean, in terms of applying for it and so on, I mean, you have been interested in poetry for a while, but did you really have a clear notion of what it would mean to be a poet laureate and, in a sense, what that would mean for you?
Yeah, I had a notion of this. For a while, I did apply a number of years ago, and so I understood what the responsibilities would be, that sort of bringing poetry to a public audience, having a specific community project or projects. So I had those ideas hammered out quite some time ago. And the time, you know, this time around I was successful, and I immediately got moving on the community project, which is Dinosaurs for Poets. I had a couple other ideas, and, you know, they're kind of tentative, we'll see, but so far Dinosaurs for Poets has been humming along quite nicely.
And this is a program I know you've done several times already, and yeah. Hope to do it more. And in a moment we'll bring in Andrew Gable, who has been, in a sense, at your side, if I understand correctly, in terms of participating in this. So let's get an introduction to Poetry for Dinosaurs and what your initial idea was.
Well, the idea is to bring science and art together, and this is something I've done with intention since I started my field work back in 2006. So I go out of my way to include artists of various stripes, whether it's painters, poets, writers, musicians, to come out and dig dinosaurs in southeastern Montana, and the hope is that rather unique and demanding setting, which contributes to the success of science and the progress of scientific knowledge, that artists are inspired by that to produce, you know, new and interesting work if they're so inclined. There's no obligation for them to do that on my end. And so this was, in terms of the laureateship, this is a very good opportunity to include and welcome artists into the Dinosaur Discovery Museum to see behind the scenes, the ideas behind the main exhibit, to get a tour through the lab and collections, which that part's led by Andrew. Just to bring artists into a unique setting, to a building and museum that's been there for a while, and maybe they haven't ever set foot in there. And so far we've had, this is a monthly program, we've had a group from Racine, to start with, for obvious reasons. Then Kenosha, and just last month, Milwaukee, we had a group. And the idea is I tour them through the main gallery that I designed back in 2004 that shows the evolution of birds through meat-eating dinosaurs. It's the largest exhibit of its kind in the country, as far as I know. And after that, they get a tour from Andrew. And then after that, there's free time to go back and revisit wherever the artists or poets want to see. And in the last half hour, if they're so inclined, they can share some work. And then at 9, it wraps up.
Wow. So is the idea that doing a tour like this will possibly inspire them to write poetry that specifically involves what they've seen and what they've experienced? Or is the connection with whatever poetry might be created, you know, not as direct as that?
Yeah, it depends. There's really no leash on it. I'm sort of interested in what spontaneously arises and what grabs people. So I'm not there to direct people's attention to a particular outcome aside from just producing a poem. Now, there's a long view of this. The laureateship is 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so I plan to have a program like this every month aside from the summer months. And a long view is that the Kenosha Public Museum has agreed to put poems on exhibit inspired by this program at the DDM, Dinosaur Discovery Museum, and they've agreed to host a public reading at the Kenosha Public Museum. And so there is a destination for this, mm-hmm. To draw attention to this new work that people have produced. And also I'd like the new work to be published in a book. So all the participants, I have their contact information so I can reach out to them as things progress over the next year and a half.
Wow. Andrew Gable, you have been assisting Dr. Carr in a number of different respects, but also in this Poetry for Dinosaurs program. I'm curious to know about your initial response and what you made of it, the whole notion of combining dinosaurs and poetry somehow. Did that strike you as perfectly logical and expected, or a bit of a surprise, maybe even a little bit of a stretch? I mean, how did you receive initially kind of the news of Dr. Carr's intentions here?
Sure. I was definitely receptive to the idea. I do some poetry myself. I actually frequent an open mic run by Nick, and the approach that I've always taken is that anything that you learn or read or experience kind of becomes part of your arsenal for poetry, and inspiration for it can arise in quite a few different ways. And as he already said, it's probably a different experience than a lot of what poets have done. A lot of poets haven't been, for one thing, in a field work setting, and it's plausible that a lot of them may not have ever been to the Dinosaur Discovery Museum at all, and they certainly haven't been in collections. So I think that is definitely fertile ground for inspiration in a lot of different ways. And one poet that actually accompanied us on the field season just this past summer, Christopher Dewdney. Natural history and geology and evolution are frequent subjects in his poetic work in addition to his nonfiction. So there is definitely a lot that can be done in terms of poetry as far as that goes. And as you said, too, sometimes the inspiration can be very tangential. Like, for example, we had one person this past session who used something in the casts on display as a metaphor for trauma. For example, in the dinosaur skeletons within the gallery, all of those skeletons are replica skeletons, but the casts that are based on the original bone are painted the color of the actual bone, whereas reconstructed bones that weren't actually found in the specimen are painted black. So she kind of took that and ran with it as a metaphor for that.
Oh, so fascinating.
So it can kind of congeal and emerge in a lot of different ways there.
Yeah. So the people who have come to this, mm-hmm. have they tended to be people that are first interested in poetry or first interested in dinosaurs or a little of both? And again, I'm sure you're not being particularly prescriptive, but just in general, I'm just kind of curious who thus far has been inclined to participate in this.
Yeah, well, I've blocked things out county by county, starting with Racine and most recently Milwaukee. And my goal has been to reach out to poets specifically. Mm. And so I have a mailing list. I'll say announce the program at open mics such as Grassroots that Nick runs, or other open mics, say up in Milwaukee at Woodland Pattern. And I, you know, hand out a list, and people sign up. And then when their month rolls around, depending on what county they're from, I'll send out the invite and flyer. And so we may have, you know, a list of 15 to 30 people, and we tend to net around a third of that.
Wow.
Which isn't bad for a free program. And so we've had, you know, anywhere from 4 to 8 people. You know, they're small groups, but very motivated and intimate groups too. So it's very, I think, helpful to communicate to small groups like that. So this is very, very targeted to the audience. And if other artists are interested, like, you know, say musicians, they're more than welcome as well. It's not exclusive, but sort of the advertising of it is in fairly exclusive settings, such as open mics.
Sure, sure. So, Nick Ramsey, I'm going to pose to you the same question I posed to Andrew, which is, how did you initially receive this, and did it strike you as something that was fertile ground for something really exciting to happen?
I thought it was awesome. You know, the reason we have co-laureates is we couldn't choose one or the other. They were both extremely awesome candidates, and what Thomas brought was something way different than what Mary brought. And so we thought, well, if they're down for this, we could have both of them, you know, hit the ground together. And so what Thomas brings is like the science world into things, you know, history, science, kind of academia and all that stuff. So when he proposed the idea of dinosaurs and poetry, I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, Thomas is always rocking his pendant, you know, his Tyrannosaurus Rex and, you know, all that stuff. So, like, that dude's holding it down, man. Mm-hmm. And it made perfect sense. And I've been happy to be there. When the Racine group was there, I was there, and I got to see it. It was my first time ever at the museum with Andrew and Thomas and others. And it was incredible. It was something I never even knew existed. And it's a very important piece of Kenosha and Racine's community. So I think, you know, putting history and science together with poetry makes sense. I thought it's going really well.
Yeah, that's great. For those of you just joining us, we are talking with three people today on the morning show. And we're talking in this first part of the program about a program created by Dr. Thomas Carr on the faculty at Carthage College, but also co-poet laureate for Racine, a program called Poetry for Dinosaurs, which began in January with presentations January, February, March, I assume. And we are in April, which is National Poetry Month, so it's a great time to be talking about this. With us today is Andrew Gable, who has been a faithful volunteer for Dr. Carr and a recent Carthage grad, and who has very much participated in the Poetry for Dinosaurs program. And Nick Ramsey, whom you were just hearing from, is on the steering committee for the Kenosha Racine Poet Laureate program. So actually, let's go back to Andrew. Talk us through, from beginning to end, what has happened, and I assume it's been largely the same with each of these three presentations that have been made. What has unfolds, I mean, from the moment they arrive to the moment they depart? Just kind of take us through the order of events, if you will.
I see. Well, the first large part of the event is a tour of the two different main spaces of the museum, the first half of which is led by Dr. Carr in the gallery. So at that part, in the gallery, at the upper exhibit, which is about the evolution of theropod dinosaurs into birds, Dr. Carr leads the attendees through partially a behind-the-scenes explanation of the rationale of why the gallery is constructed the way it is, why the replica skeletons are arranged in the way that they are. He talks about some of the artistic influences of that in ancient Egyptian art, for example. But then also the biology of the dinosaurs themselves and the evolution of various bones on the path to becoming birds, etc. And then the second half of the tour is led by myself. We go downstairs to the lab and collections. I explain some of the real fossils in the cases, and then I kind of lead the tour through the lab, show them what I've been working on and what some recent student volunteers have been working on in the lab space as well. And then I bring them into the collections. I kind of explain the purpose of collections, and I show them around there some of the fossils that we have collected in Montana. And then after that, there is some free time to get some refreshments or revisit the exhibits and write. And then at the final half hour of the event, anybody who feels so inclined who has written something is free to share that work with everybody else there.
And we're talking at least primarily about something that they have written right then and there.
Yes.
I mean, during the course of this visit.
Yep.
Wow, that's great. That's great. So, Dr. Carr, how would you characterize? I mean, you've already deemed this success, and I would say rightly so. Very specifically, in terms of the nature of poetry that has been generated or created or inspired through the course of this program, what has been kind of the nature of that, or is it impossible to generalize or summarize?
I guess it's difficult to generalize. We've really maybe heard three or four pieces that people have written, and I make it clear that this isn't poetry on demand, that you must produce something within 3 hours. That's not the case at all. I make it very clear that there's nearly 2 years of runway on this. But we've been very lucky to have each time someone has written something and shared that. So we had musician Jay Malerskoff produce a sound poem based on one of the dinosaur names. Cynognathoid, and that was really interesting because he read that in the gallery, which has great sort of echoey acoustics for what he does. We had another musician, Wilhelm Matisse, write a poem about the Berlin specimen of Archaeopteryx. It's one of the best Archaeopteryx fossils ever found. We have a cast of it, and Wilhelm read that, and we had a young poet named Harper who read, I think, a couple pieces, and also Harper's friend who was along. So it's been really cool to see, work get produced there and have it shared on the spot. That's not really an expectation, but for me, that's icing on the cake to see that people really are gripping into this and it really is lighting some candles.
Yeah. I'm a little surprised. I am not a poet, but I've always just kind of assumed that it tends to be something that involves a whole lot of rumination and rough drafts and fine long-term polishing before you have this finished product, and this idea of poetry being created not quite extemporaneously but in a very constricted time frame. And again, you're not requiring this of anybody, but it just, I guess, the notion never even occurred to me that someone might be inclined to create a brand new poem in such quick fashion.
Yeah, well, I find that, when I'm in a new and strange situation, the the muse will stop using me as her ashtray and we'll get on with it. But kidding aside, it's a unique setting and that's bound to set off a bunch of new and unexpected associations, as Andrew mentioned. I find it very hard to write on command myself. I've been struggling with writing a poem about the spring, and it's a lot of work, admittedly. But in a new circumstance, then, those areas of inspiration become accessible in a way that they weren't on the normal day-to-day.
Right. It brings to mind something Andrew mentioned earlier, and I think you've mentioned this as well, that you have welcomed the participation of people who are not necessarily scientists to your dinosaur digs out in Montana, and that the hope has been that for at least some of them, this might be a kind of a spark of their creative endeavors as poets or composers or whatever. Just give us a sense of the kind of thing during one of those dinosaur digs that might actually spark the creation of something artistic. I mean, what sort of thing might somebody experience or see that could be an inspiration?
Well, I guess I'll start. I think just seeing a fossil in the ground, like someone's never been in that circumstance before, that can be a very powerful experience. Mm. Even for me, when I come across, like a really nice Triceratops frill that's just lying there, it's sort of shocking in a way that, that coincidence of happening to be there at the moment or when the, erosion's done its job. I think people are also really captivated by just the tasks of the science. Christopher Dewdney was really into putting a field jacket on a Triceratops femur last summer. Like, that seemed to be a highlight for him among many highlights. So I'm often curious to see what does inspire people and what captivates them. You can't always predict what that'll be, depending on the personality.
Yeah. Andrew, do you have anything to add as someone who's been on many of these dinosaur digs?
Sure. I think for a lot of people, it's a question of scale. In terms of the landscape of Montana, how open the skies are, the size of some of the landforms in the Badlands area, but then also when confronted with various types of dinosaur fossils, a lot of the charisma that that has over a lot of people is just the size of these animals themselves. But then also the really, at the end of the day, kind of inconceivable amount of time that has passed. I think that that has an effect on some people if they really contemplate that as well.
Right. Yeah, that is, I hadn't stopped to think about that at all, and probably most of us don't stop to think about the eons that have between when this creature walked the earth and you finding its remains and all of that time, and what does that time mean? And yeah, I can see how that would be incredibly inspiring. By the way, you mentioned in passing that you've done a bit of poetry writing yourself.
Sure.
I mean, are you too busy with all the tasks that Dr. Carr lays on you for, or have you found even yourself on these trips that sometimes there have been moments of inspiration?
Oh, do you mean like writing in the field?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, a bit. This past field season, because I was field assistant, I was doing a little bit more running around than the volunteers were, for instance. Both of us in practice, we don't really write out there very much in terms of that, but there are definitely some moments that can be mined for later inspiration.
Right, when time permits and so on.
Yeah. I did write a little something this last year has since been reworked extensively into something passable, I think.
Very good. So Dr. Carr, you created this program in January, and as we said, it's been presented three times already.
Yes.
Folks from Kenosha, from Racine, from Milwaukee,
yeah.
And you want it to go on from here. And it will it essentially be, in a sense, more of the same, but you hope with different people or some of these same people returning? Or how do you see this over the long term? What will it look like?
Yeah, well, the next group I'm inviting is English department faculty and creative writing students at Carthage. Then I'll reach out to Gateway. And so I'm shifting my attention to colleges and universities, UW-Parkside, as well, but in a very systematic fashion. And in the second year, I really want to pivot to include creative writing students at local high schools. And that'll be sort of the end of the runway for the program. And then hopefully there will be a substantive body of work to share at the end. So that's the overall view of this, is to start with the artistic community and then fan out to educators and students.
Mm. Love that. So Nick Ramsey, as you are hearing this conversation as you have seen with your own eyes, this Poetry for Dinosaurs program playing out, what does it make you think of, and how does this compare with other projects that have happened under the auspices of the Poet Laureate program?
I'd say that the biggest thing that I've come across right now is like how fast someone is jumping into their program and project. Usually it takes a year and a half for it to like really get going. Tom has jumped in like the first weeks of it and started going hardcore for it. So obviously, as a committee member and someone who wants to make sure that the laureates are supported as best as they can be, to see this level of exertion towards it up front is really exciting, because it's like, it's going to be done. It's going to be completed. The project's set out there, it's laid out, and it's like already rolling. So I'm just happy to know that that's what's happening. And there's crazy amounts of obligations, like we could throw at any of our laureates. It's like opportunities, not obligations. But so if I get a chance in a little bit, I'd like to talk about some of the other things that, the laureates are going to be doing and the program's going to be doing. But this is an excellent start to it.
Absolutely. And, yeah. No, please tell us about some other things that are going on that you are excited about.
well, it being National Poetry Month, obviously the committee gets together and they're like, what can we do? You know, our laureate's got to work, you know, got to get it in. So our laureates are going to be featured at the Grassroots Open Mic, which happens every second and fourth Wednesday at Spectrum School of the Arts. I run that, and Thomas helps out a lot. Andrew very, very frequently shows up and helps out too. So we're going to be featuring all of the laureates this next Wednesday, the 9th, 7 o'clock, Spectrum School of the Arts. So we're going to have Dr. Carr, Mary Skillings, Nico Moore, all represented that night in a feature slot. So that's something that's really excited. When Thomas was talking about writing about spring, I tasked them all because the Racine Parks and Recreation Department has given the opportunity for us to put poetry into the parks. And so I tasked all of them with coming up with a nature spring-based themed poem, and we're going to be putting those up into the parks, specifically Colonial Park. So that's coming up. We're just waiting on Dr. Carr's stuff. Now I'm just messing around a little bit. We got to get a little bit more formatted or whatever, but that should be up pretty darn soon. So that's coming up. Obviously, there's poetry's bubbling. It's rolling really, really well. And the community of Kenosha and Racine, we're cousins. I like to think of it as we're cousins. It's really, really strong. And when all the poets unite, everybody's rolling to different sets and whatnot, it's really a beautiful thing. So the Kenosha Racine Poets Laureate group has been really fostering an enormous amount of support for the poets and the laureates and just the general community of poetry. So those are a few things that are happening, not to mention the, you know, poems on buses, not to mention mm-hmm. the wall poem, big murals that are happening throughout the community. Poetry's alive and well.
It certainly is. You have a big part to do with that. Just say an additional word about these open mic events at Spectrum. I mean, apart from the one coming up next week, which is, of course, extra special because of the participation of the Poets Laureate. But on a so-called normal night with the open mic, just describe to our listeners what typically occurs.
Well, I don't know if I'm able to give, like, shout-outs to, like, you know, supporters and, like, funders and stuff like
whatever.
That. But I do want to shout out the Osborne and Sekich Family Foundation because they are instrumental in supporting so many arts initiatives, including our open mic. So basically what happens, people come in, 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock is gather time. We also get a sponsorship from Wilson's Coffee and Tea.
Ah.
So the good family, the Wilson family, they always hook us up with a pound of coffee donated for the open mic. So we got a pot of coffee brewing. We got sometimes snacks that are happening, artwork everywhere. If you've never been to Spectrum, it's a banner year for them. It's 45 years as a school, 30 years as a cooperative, and now we're at 15 years for the Grassroots Open Mic. So you see the numbers and the numerology there. So, 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock, it's just gathering, drink coffee, tour the space, check out the artwork. 7 o'clock, open mic starts. We do the crowd energizing or deflating action and activity. Activity that's called the Holy Moly. And then the open mic happens for 45 minutes. The feature performer, if that's like one or many people, get to do a 30-minute set. And then we close out with the second open mic portion. So this last one, we had a filmmaker. We had a gentleman who invents his own instruments, plays music. We got original musicians, some cover songs that come up there. We got rappers and dancers and poets and everything you could think of. We're proud to have them feature on the stage there at Grassroots.
Fantastic. Again, that's the second and fourth Wednesdays.
Of every month at Spectrum School of the Arts, yep.
Fantastic. Thomas Carr, anything you want to say in closing?
Yeah, I guess sort of the overall intent of Dinosaurs for Poets is to bring science and art together. And it just, in general, it seems in society that there's an unnecessary gulf between people and the happenings and the doings of science. And so this is a real opportunity to lift the lid on that, to give people an experience of the authentic and the real and scientific progress and the scientific process itself. And I think it's a rare opportunity, and I think it's the best way I can think of giving back to the community. The poetic artistic community here has treated me very well over the past couple years, and this is one way of giving back, of sort of returning that, that welcome and that good treatment by inviting people in and to have a look under the hood of science.
Hmm. I like that. That's put very, very nicely. And just to kind of underscore that point, when I first learned that you were Poet Laureate, I mean, I was absolutely thunderstruck. I mean, in all of our conversations, right, that had never come up. Right. And that even sort of speaks to the divide, mm-hmm, that it had, never occurred to me to ask you. It never, yeah, occurred to you to say anything and so on. So even for us, there has been kind of that divide of these two worlds. And yeah, anything that encourages the intersection is such a good thing, and particularly, yeah, when there is somebody steeped in the sciences who also has this love and talent for an artistic endeavor like poetry. It's a good thing all around.
Yeah, I guess the key word here is literacy, right? So poetry brings linguistic and artistic literacy to the table, and then this program, invites people to become, scientifically literate in one little corner of that sandbox.
Fantastic. I love that. Dr. Thomas Carr from the faculty at Carthage College, his devoted assistant, Andrew Gable, and Nick Ramsey from the steering committee for the Poets Laureate program in both Kenosha and Racine. It's been wonderful to talk about the beauty and importance of poetry with all of you. Thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And here is part two of today's program here on WGTV. Well, once again, American Heritage Dictionaries have come up with a delightful little book which really belongs on everybody's shelf. And the title really, in a sense, says it all. 100 Words Almost Everyone Confuses and Misuses. This comes on the heels of several other books of a similar dimension in which the editors of the American Heritage Dictionaries have taken us into a list of 100 words of one kind or another. And we're talking with Stephen Kleinedler, who is senior editor with American Heritage Dictionaries. And first of all, Stephen Kleinedler, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Remind me of the precursors to this particular book that we're talking about today.
Right. So far, we've already come out with 100 words every high school graduate should know and 100 words every high school freshman should know.
Very good. I know in talking about those that we bandied about the question of why 100, and I enjoyed your answer, and I want to hear that answer again.
It's still the same answer. It makes for a nice size. 10 words or 50 words would be really too small to put into print. It'd be more like a pamphlet. If you go more than that, it becomes... This book is meant as an impulse buy or something that you can give as a gift for graduation or the holidays or for a birthday.
And a good so stocking stuffer.
It's a good stocking stuffer and inexpensive at $4.95. And it's just the right size for that type of gift-giving occasion.
I have a feeling it must have been so much fun for you and your colleagues to assemble this list of 100. Tell us what that process was like. I mean, were you all just sitting around a table bandying about various words, or how did this list take shape?
Well, this list is slightly different from the other ones in that the 100 words every high school graduate or freshman should know, you've got a lot of very interesting vocabulary items, whereas this book of words that people confuse and misuse, you have a lot of common words like sit and set or lie and lay that might not be as exotic as some of the longer ones. But what we did with this one is we took usage information that exists in the American Heritage Dictionary along with our Book of English Usage, and we tailored these notes to this kind of format. And so much of the fun came, as with the other books, we tried to provide interesting illustrations from literature, both classic and contemporary, going into the literature and finding items that we could use to demonstrate and illustrate some of the words.
Right. I guess some of these words are relatively common at a glance, and then as soon as we start reading a little further, we realize, oh my gosh, I have been not quite understanding this word correctly, or just mixing it up with something.
Exactly.
Or forgetting that a word has two significant meanings, and maybe the one we have just kind of shunted off to the side.
That's right. And, you know, and the fun came in researching these, and as a result, we get quotes, everything from Bram Stoker to Jimmy Carter to William Least Heat Moon. A lot of nice ways to show how people who use words as part of their job use them correctly in context.
Exactly. Now, explain for us, for instance, why what seems like as simple a word as wreck should be on this list.
Well, again, it's the same reason why we had a ziggurat on another list. to round out the alphabet, obviously we don't have like an X word this time because there just aren't that many confusing things. But we were rounding out the end of the alphabet, but also because people do tend to, we have seen evidence of people confusing reek and wreck.
Oh, yes, wreaking havoc as opposed to...
Exactly, versus wrecking havoc, which isn't technically the correct way. And then also to point out that the past tense and past participle of wreak is wreaked and not wrought, which is an alternative past tense, past participle of work. So there's a lot of interplay going on there.
Right. Some things are even more immediately clear that, for instance, you give us unexceptional and unexceptionable. And boy, what a difference two letters can make.
True. Some of these word pairs are kind of shades of gray as to how bad the confusion is. But in many cases with these word pairs, if you're interested in expressing yourself clearly and effectively, the nuances that separate one meaning from the other are actually very useful. And if you're aware of what they are, and if your audience is aware of what they are, you can convey your thoughts effectively. And of course, if you don't know what they are and your audience does, you may find yourself saying something you didn't mean to say. You know, we can understand why these two words are confused. Both come from the word exception. Unexceptionable takes its meaning from exception, the sense objection, as in the idiom take exception to. Thus, unexceptional is commendatory, meaning not open to criticism, as in a judge's ethical standard should be unexceptionable. Unexceptional, on the other hand, is related to the adjective exceptional, above average, which takes the meaning an unusual case. Thus, unexceptional usually has a negative meaning, meaning not superior, as in some judges' ethical standards, sadly, have been unexceptional. So the two words are kind of opposite in meaning, and if you're going to use them, you kind of want to be clear so you don't go saying the wrong thing. And if you're still confused, you can use different turns of phrase to state what you want to state clearly.
Right. A few things are here because of matters of pronunciation.
That is correct.
And, of course, one of the most infamous of them all is here to represent the letter N,
yes.
Nuclear.
Nuclear, yes. And it's worth pointing out, a lot of people, you can make a lot of political hay with this, but we've found both Democratic and Republican presidents in the past who have said this, so it gets equal usage, or rather equal misusage.
I wanted to mention that I'm sad that one of my favorite incorrect words is not right after it to represent the letter O. Which is, I hear so many people say orientated.
Orientated.
When I think they mean oriented.
Orientate isn't incorrect in as much as it's less succinct. Orientate is a back formation, of course, from orientation. The back formation is a productive way of creating new words in English. It's where we get the word babysit, because either babysitter or babysitting, I forget which came first, and babysit was a back formation from that. However, in the case of orientate, you have a perfectly good orient, which is simpler and sounds a little less jargony. So there are definitely reasons one might want to use orient instead of orientate, but orientate isn't wrong per se.
Ah, all right.
It does. I agree with you. It can become cliched through overuse.
Right. Well, I'll put away my weapons then on that one.
Yes. There are reasons to strike out against it, but so.
Right. Am I remembering that homonyms are when a word is pronounced the same but spelled differently?
No. You see, homonyms, homographs, and homophones are three different phenomena, and there is some overlap. A homophone, of course, are two words that sound alike, but may or may not have a different spelling. So night and night, one with the K, one without the K, are homophones. But homophones can sometimes be spelled the same. A homograph are two words that are spelled the same, but they have a different meaning. So, for example, of homograph, you would have fair, meaning pleasing in appearance, and fair, a market, or wind and wind. In this case, they're pronounced differently, but spelled the same.
So, right.
And then a homonym is two or more words that have the same sound, often the same spelling, but differ in meaning, such as the two kinds of banks, one on the side of the river, one in a place where you keep money. So there's overlap between
right.
the terms.
So, for instance, the one that caught my eye, which then would be a homonym, would be complement and compliment.
Yes, it is also a homophone. They sound alike, but there, of course, is a distinction, and this is one of those classic ones where language pundits and grammar teachers are very quick to point out the difference. And in this case, there is a definite difference. The complement, a noun meaning something that completes, makes up a whole, or brings to perfection, and compliment with an I, which is an expression of praise, are two separate words, and one that people often confuse, and one should take care not to confuse.
Very good. As you put this book together, were you thinking a lot about entertaining the reader, or is it safe to say that this book, perhaps even more than the others, is really designed to help the reader speak better and write better?
It's a bit of both. The goal of these books, of course, is to be entertaining and to get people to take a shining to reference works. It's a gateway to using the dictionary itself. And therefore, when we didn't take the notes part and parcel from the dictionary, we jazzed them up a bit, we changed them up a bit so that they would be interesting to read, to invite browsing, and be kind of friendly. And we go out of our way to point out, in some cases, words that are criticized by language pundits or that sort of people, they are so widely used that it's difficult to say don't do this because everyone does it. But what we do point out is if you wish to be thought of as a conscientious speaker or you're making a formal presentation, then you'll want to be aware of these rules and guidelines because the people judging you certainly are.
Right. Well, and what's also cool about this book, I think, is that you bring to mind some of the inexact nature of this science of words.
I was going to say language isn't necessarily logical. You can't put a Boolean logic on language. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
You're right.
Well, and for instance, when you talk about two words like enormity and enormousness,
yes.
You talk about how there are people that really want to reserve the word enormity for one thing and use enormousness for something else. And that starts to sound like a simple matter of opinion, which is not easily resolved.
And it does, and that's why we point it out. I mean, and it's a service to the reader to point out that if you use these words, depending on your audience, you may be conveying the exact opposite of what you're trying to convey. So, it's forewarned is forearmed.
Absolutely. Well, I really enjoyed this, as I'm sure many people would. Again, the book is 100 Words Almost Everyone Confuses and Misuses, published by Houghton Mifflin, and it comes from the good folks of Houghton Mifflin, and Stephen Kleinedler is a senior editor that is with the American Heritage Dictionaries, responsible for this great book.
Well, thank
Stephen
you very
Kleinedler,
much.
I enjoyed speaking with you.
Well, thank you. Have a good day.
And tomorrow on the morning show, Sam Ashworth talks about his most recent novel, and a truly remarkable and exceptional one, called The Life and Death of August Sweeney. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find it archived on our website, wgtd.org. It's also available as a podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today's going to be a mostly sunny day, windy and mild, a high of 56 degrees. Overnight, a few clouds and a low of 35. Partly cloudy tomorrow, a 30% chance of afternoon rain with a high of 51 degrees. Very similar forecast on Saturday with a high of 53. Sunshine should return on Sunday with a high of 49 degrees. Actually, a little bit chillier on Monday and Tuesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn,